It's so good. Before we call the first case, I would like to acknowledge that we have here in the courtroom a group of students from the Grant Bowler Elementary School in Logandale. Is that right? And who's their teacher? Thank you for attending, and I hope that today's proceeding is interesting. It's the Project Rio Week in the school, sir.
Yes, a social studies unit that they've been working on at our school.
And what grade?
Fifth grade.
Great. Thank you very much for being here. I hope this is pretty interesting to you all. The first case on calendar is Bardo versus Bracey, case number 58778. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes,
ma'am. Okay, very well. Mr. Bryson?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you want to reserve any time?
I would. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for purposes of rebuttal, 12 minutes for my case in chief argument.
Perfect.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to everyone. And to counsel. My name is Ebert Bryson. Assisting me today is John Thurer Clark, also Bonnie C. Ayres. The issues presented in this appeal really is the supporting affidavit required under NRS 41A.071. It's become part of the complaint so that it's read in conjunction with the complaint. And in essence, that is going to require us, I believe, to determine what constitutes a supporting affidavit. The second issue before the court is if the supporting affidavit is originally attached to and filed with the complaint, can it be amended? In this case, we had one district court judge that found that Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit supported the complaint. We had another district court judge found that it did not. Both district court judges found that the affidavit under the teachings of Russia could not be amended. Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit is found at AAP 9 through 12. I submit to this court that the threshold requirements, and the key is the threshold requirements of an affidavit requires under NRS 41A.071 at the initial pleading stage are not the same requirements to withstand a motion for summary judgment or to ultimately win a trial in the litigation. Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit was sufficient under the statute. And let's take a look at what the statute requires. It requires an expert affidavit, properly sworn to, or a declaration signed under penalty of perjury. The expert has to practice or practice in the same or similar field that supports the allegations, and that's where we're really going to be here. And the affidavit has to be attached to the original complaint. In Seidel, this court already has found that NRS 41A.071 is unambiguous. So the statute is okay on its face. Thus, when we look to the wording, as Justice Sayeda has previously said, we should construe and take a look at the words in the statute very strictly. The very wording of the statute says that it cannot stand alone. That being the affidavit, because it must support. We submit to this court that once the affidavit is attached to the complaint, and that's a requirement that this court has deemed has to be, Justice Hardison said that it's jurisdictional. I agree that it's jurisdictional. But that affidavit, when it becomes attached, unlocks the key to the house so that when you walk into the house, then all the rules, duties, and obligations of the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure should apply. Otherwise, what we're doing is creating a super class of defendants. I do not believe that's the legislative intent. I certainly can't believe that, based upon anything that I have read in any of the published case decisions that have been rendered by this court, that that's what this court intends. So, if it's the requirement that the affidavit be attached, then it becomes one document.
Mr. Bryson, our law seems to be silent as to this issue. Have you found anything in competing jurisdictions that would lead us in a direction as to supporting the allegations contained in the action language out of the statute?
Well, there is some case law, learned counsel, opposing counsel, cited to Minnesota and Texas, so did I, and brought it back. In those particular jurisdictions, you had X amount of time period to make amendments and to cure any perceived deficiencies. Minnesota calls it a safe harbor provision. We don't have this here. So what's happening is we have a statute that is currently being used to deprive litigants of meritorious claims on technicalities or perceived deficiencies, unlike any other area of the law that I'm aware of. So the answer to that question is yes, but part of that is the statutes are a little different.
And I guess my question within the question is, looking at the statute, and I'm not sure an affidavit requirement deprives anybody of anything. It's just a requirement that you do something. The question is whether or not there's a minimum flooring of what you must submit in the affidavit.
And I think there is. And I think we have met that, and I want to tell you what Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit includes. Then I have a proposed test. I don't know if you guys can take it for what it's worth. I'm certainly not as smart as the legislator, but it's something that we need. We need some kind of a standard, because every other part of the statute, the attorneys understand, the litigants understand, and the courts understand.
Is that minimum flooring for an affidavit contained in the NRS or in legal case pronouncements of our jurisdiction or any other jurisdiction?
And I'm not completely sure I understand. It has to comply, the Mountain View case said it has to comply with the general requirements of an affidavit. Absolutely. Or we've now expanded that to include a declaration. So yes, in those regards, does it have to comply with the same rigorous standards to oppose a motion for summary judgment or to prove up a case at trial? Absolutely not, because it's a threshold requirement. There's no competing affidavits. In this Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit, this is what he set forth, and I submit to the court that that's all that's required under the statute. He set forth his proper qualifications to render an expert opinion. He reviewed the medical records, which is one of the issues that was part of the legislative intent. You want to make sure you review some records and can come forward. He set forth the treatment history. He set forth the dates and locations of treatment. He set forth the applicable standard of care and how the treatment fell below the standard of care, and the affidavit was attached to the original complaint. And that seems
if
to
I
be...
If I may interrupt you.
Yes, please, Your
he also set forth one other thing in paragraph 3, and it was that this affidavit was being tendered to assess the care provided by the physician assistant, Matthew McGarren. There's no reference in the affidavit to the defendant in the case, and so my concern is, can a person rely on an affidavit under the statute that is tendered in connection with one medical practitioner, but use it for a malpractice case against another medical practitioner?
If you take a look at the affidavit, and obviously you have, it specifically references that particular doctor, but it also specifically references conduct that occurred, and granted, the cut that occurred on December 31st, 2009, it demonstrates in paragraph 6 of Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit, it references the same visit that is referenced in paragraph 14 of the complaint. In paragraph 14 of the complaint, it is specifically referenced Dr. Bracy. So in other words, you've got both the complaint and the supporting affidavit stating the date Dr. Bracy saw the appellant, the prescribed course of treatment by Dr. Bracy, and that there were breaches of the standard of care. And Dr. Bracy was named as a defendant. Had he not been named,
I'm sorry for interrupting your answer. Go ahead and finish.
What I'm saying is, if he hadn't been named as a defendant in the litigation, if there had been no conduct mentioned, where Dr. Bracy was the only doctor that saw the appellant on December 31st, if there was no way to identify him, I would say no, that would not be good enough. And in a perfect world, would I tell you that the affidavit could have been more specifically drafted? Absolutely. That's why we have rules that you don't have to get that that bullseye on the very first shot. And but what's happening in these type of cases is you have to, because if you don't hit it dead center, and by the way, the affidavit that was utilized was based upon Dr. Goldsmith's wording. The actual complaint was what I drafted. The complaint specifically referenced the treatment and Dr. Bracey's name.
I didn't have time to look at the record in this, and I don't know if it shows it, but I assume that the physician assistant, Matthew McGarren, saw the patient on December 31st as discussed in paragraph 6 in addition to Dr. Bracey. Is that right?
I believe he saw him on the 30th, and then he came back on the 31st. He came back several times.
But McGarren saw him both days?
My understanding is he only saw him on the first day, which would be December 30th. And then he came back on the 31st. Then finally, it was a couple days before. I apologize, I don't know that exact date. But on the 31st, it's my understanding that he was only seen by Dr. Bracey.
But I respect your point that this gets to be pretty technical. And that's troublesome for access to the court system. I appreciate that point. But I am concerned about a rule, and I'd love to hear your test. I'm very interested in what you have to suggest, but I'm very concerned about a rule that permits an affidavit that expresses a failure of standard of care against one medical practitioner, and then is used against another medical practitioner in a complaint where the affidavit doesn't even recite that defendant. And this is a problem. So how do we overcome that, and what's your test?
Well, let me get to the test. But first of all, I would like to read, and I promise I'll do the test, but I want to read that, and it's in AAP 56. In the respondent's reply to the motion to dismiss, they do not argue that Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit does not support the complaint. This is what they argue. By way of clarification, Dr. Bracey's argument, as set forth in the motion to dismiss, is not that Dr. Goldsmith's affidavit fails to support the allegations made in the complaint. They say that it doesn't fail. Right there. So that's what the statute requires, is support. What they say is rather the deficiency is that the allegations relating to Dr. Bracey are not supported by the affidavit of Dr. Goldsmith. It's circular, and what they're really wanting to happen when you look at the legislative intent and what was argued is that they want this to meet the rigors of an affidavit for a motion for summary judgment and to stand up at trial instead of being a threshold requirement. The threshold requirement is the key. Now, the test, as I promised.
Before you get there, if this complaint had not named Dr. Bracey as a defendant and you had the exact same affidavit attached to it, and then you amended the complaint to add Dr. Bracey as a defendant, would your argument be the same?
No, and that's a good point. If he hadn't been named as a defendant in the complaint, if he hadn't been referenced in the complaint, then no, I would say that he would not be allowed, that the affidavit would not support because you would have the bare allegations. Here, when read together, it is clear, I submit to you, it's disingenuous to argue.
The affidavit as a standalone, if you just had a notice pleading complaint, the affidavit would have only stood against Botto.
If it was meant to be standalone, by the very wording of the statute, I don't believe that an affidavit
is. I just wanted to understand your point, but go ahead.
And furthermore, I think it's important, and this has never been overruled, Borger states that a complaint should only be dismissed when there is a complete failure. A complete failure to comply with the statute.
Does paragraph 12, is that enough to get Bracey into this case? That is my professional opinion that the medical care delivered was below the standard of care for the following reasons. Is that enough to get Bracey in this case?
For the threshold requirement, I submit to this court that it is when read in conjunction with paragraph 6 of the affidavit and paragraph 14 of the complaint.
What if we don't read it in conjunction with the complaint? What if this court decides that we don't read these affidavits? And is this affidavit, can we say that the trial court abused her discretion by saying that the affidavit was insufficient.
Yes.
By looking at paragraph 12.
Yes, because it sets forth the conduct that is related. And we should be allowed to amend. Let me get to the test, if that answers your question. We need some kind of a test. I propose the following two-part test. The first prong of the test is as follows. Whether the allegations contained in the complaint are substantially similar and do not contradict the supporting affidavit. If so, does the complaint set forth sufficient allegations that, if accepted as true, would allow for the relief requested? If we have a test similar to that, then all of a sudden now, instead of being in conflict with the rules of civil procedure, we can now have a harmonization between NRS 41A.071 and all the other rules of civil procedure, which is what Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure 1 says. These are applicable to everyone.
So would it be enough if Dr. Goldsmith had just said in his affidavit, you have your detailed complaint and it sets out the duty and the breach and the specifics. If Goldsmith's affidavit had just said, I believe there was medical malpractice in this case, do you think that would suffice and we should allow amendment?
No, because I think you need more. I would submit to you, you would have to say, I'm qualified to render the opinion.
But the opinion piece, if it's, I believe there was medical malpractice in this case.
For the threshold requirement, I would say yes. That would meet the threshold requirement.
I'll give you your 2 minutes on rebuttal. You've exhausted your time.
Thank you. Well, that's an issue, because the only way I can resolve that for 1 minute and just get to the amendment issue, because we have not yet hit the amendment issue.
You know, I've got a question in that regard before you even go there, and you'll probably answer the question, but if we allow this to relate back to the complaint, why do you even need an amendment if this is sufficient?
Excuse me?
If we assume that this relates to the complaint, the affidavit, why would you need an amendment to it in any event?
Because it's sufficient then, and that
you have to amend it?
It's like a request for a more definite statement. They're saying this doesn't mean it, so we're saying, okay, we can.
Yeah, if we say it in attaching this to the complaint and looking at it, that it's okay, then why would you need an amendment?
Well, I do not believe that we need to, but at a minimum, if you find a deficiency, then you should be allowed to amend like in every other case. Board, we know that, first of all, the statute is silent as to amendments. It doesn't say it can't be amended. Second, Borger states it recognizes that. And so I would submit that if a district court determines that there is a legitimate dispute as to the sufficiency of the supporting affidavit, then in its sound discretion, it can allow for the amendment. Because Borger talks about Rule 12 jurisprudence, that the rule, the affidavit rule, should be read in conjunction with Rule 12 jurisprudence. Then when you get to Washaw, it says, well, you don't get 15A or 15C because it's void ab initio. If you take that logic ultimately, then Rule 12 doesn't even apply because there's no complaint for it to apply to.
But your position here is this affidavit is not deficient.
But my position is, under the law as it stands right now, the affidavit is not sufficient. In the event it is sufficient, we have met the key to unlock the lock, to get into the house, which is jurisdictional. We met the key, we get in, give us a chance to amend, and we'll cure the deficiency. And if we can't, then it gets dismissed.
You have to overrule Washoe to be able to do what you're saying?
Absolutely not. This actually, I submit to you, this argument actually brings into line all of the teachings said about in this area of the law. Because now we can have a harmonization, not only of NRS 41A.071, but with all the other rules of civil procedure. And we're not creating a superclass. Because we have to have the same rules of civil procedure for everybody. We can carve out certain things and make certain things jurisdictional. But in the end, we have to equally apply the law to everyone. Thank you. I don't know, maybe 15 seconds or 20 seconds left. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ms. Robichaud, I'll ask the clerk to add 2 minutes to your time as well.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I want to thank the court for its attention and consideration of this very important topic. My name is Yvette Robichaud. I represent the respondent, Dr. Jeff Bracey, who is also the defendant in the case below. This case presents the recurring question of law, which is the satisfaction of the expert affidavit requirement under NRS 41A.071. The statute, because we are interpreting the law, the standard of review is de novo. The statute that we're looking at today, 41A.071, states that if a medical malpractice action is filed in the district court shall dismiss the action if the action is filed without an affidavit supporting the allegations contained in the action and submitted by a medical expert. So, beginning with the Border case in 2004, this court has issued 5 opinions interpreting this affidavit requirement. So what's new about this case? What's new is that we have an affidavit attached to the complaint, but the affidavit never names the negligent actor, Dr. Bracey, never names him. It never attributes negligent conduct to Dr. Bracey. It gives no basis to the court to be able to determine whether there is merit to the claims as to Dr. Bracey. With respect to the facts, in paragraph 12, which the court asked about, paragraph 12 lists 6 items of conduct that simply says the items of conduct are substandard, never assigns that care to any defendant, much let alone to Dr. Bracey.
But the position is you look to the complaint and it's a general allegation as to lack of care. In this affidavit listing specifically the malpractice, and you take that...
Yes, I understand, Judge. I believe that that is the problem. The new thing that the plaintiff is asking us to do is to be able to interpret the affidavit with the complaint to buffer a defective affidavit. And my response to that is a resounding no. It would be an untenable interpretation of that statute to allow the complaint to buffer a defective affidavit. The expert affidavit requirement explicitly calls for expert opinion, competent expert opinion. It does not call for looking to the lawyer to name the negligence. And that's what's problematic about relying on the complaint.
Ms. Roger, my concern is this, is what Mr. Bryson mentioned. Normally, you can amend and all of that. Here, there was clearly substantial compliance here. You had these allegations in here. And if, let's say Dr. Bracey's name was spelled wrong, maybe it was Dr. Spacey or something like that. Is he out because you don't have the name spelled right? Where do you draw the line between something that appears inadvertent here versus something that's substantive, like a city affidavit wasn't even signed, or like we've had in some of these other cases?
I agree. The Mountain View case was an example of that. Mm-hmm. I think that what we're looking for is some part of the test that this court, when it announces its opinion in this case, that lawyers and the courts can rely on to determine if the affidavit is sufficient.
Plus the sufficiency of that affidavit, are we guided by the fact that we are notice pleading jurisdiction?
Notice pleading jurisdiction certainly allows a generic statement in the complaint. But even Rule 8 does not allow a statement in the complaint to be so broad that the defendant does not know what he needs to come in and defend against. And so the affidavit requirement and its history, the legislative history as to the expert affidavit, is that the purpose of the affidavit requirement is to ensure that cases are brought based on competent expert opinion. It is the policy and the spirit behind the act to deter the filing of frivolous claims. It makes sense that if you have competent expert opinion that you will not have a frivolous claim. Maybe frivolous is too strong a word. Maybe the word is that the case is filed prematurely or that there is the case is not ripe for decision. But the legislature was absolutely clear and Verger stated the purpose of the affidavit was to ensure that cases were brought based on competent expert opinion, not the lawyer's naming of negligence. If you allow the complaint to name the negligence, unfortunately, it could open the door to fraudulent claims. The expert affidavit could be global and never name any individual. It could name, as we have in this case, six items saying the care is substandard. Then that global affidavit goes back to the lawyer's office, and the office can add one name, it can add three names, it can add five names, and we don't know if that's what the expert intended. And we won't know until we depose the expert 12 to 18 months down the road when we're getting ready for trial. That is not what the legislature ever intended. The defendants should not be appearing and defending cases in which they don't know that there is merit to the claims. It's a cost containment measure that the legislature fashioned. It is expensive to litigate frivolous claims. It's expensive for the court in terms of time, effort, expense. It's expensive for the defendant whose liability premiums are going to go up because he's been named. It's expensive.
Counsel, may I interrupt your commentary just a moment?
Yes.
It seems to me that there is two separate issues in the case. One is whether the affidavit is sufficient to support the complaint or whether it can be amended. And following up on Justice Gibbons' earlier question, do you agree that there are circumstances where the affidavit could be amended because perhaps the medical practitioner's name has been misspelled?
Yes. I agree that there are instances in which the affidavit can be amended. I think that those things are such as expert credentials and scope of practice. I think you can amend that. But I don't think that you can amend the guts of the affidavit, which is the expert opinion. That opinion needs to be intact and integrated on its front end. That's what the legislature called for, wasn't competent.
Then let me ask you this.
Yes.
Would an affidavit be sufficient, not dealing with the amendment question, but would the affidavit be sufficient if, as in this case, the affidavit recited the practice experience and so forth, but for the opinion, the expert said, I've read the complaint and I agree with it in my professional opinion. That's all it said.
I don't think that that is sufficient. I think the expert opinion, the guts of that is the expert has to say, I've read the records. Based on the records, I have opinions, and here's what they are. Expert opinion is not foreign to this court or to any court. We have expert opinions all the time. We see it in the Rule 16.1 exchange of expert affidavits. We have experts coming to trial every day offering opinions. The expert says, this is the standard, and here's my opinion of how the standard was violated. That's what the legislature called for, competent expert opinion on the front end of filing the case so that the court can do its job. The district court is going to receive the challenge from the individual defendant that case is not sufficient. As to him, the individual defendant does not come in and challenge the entire case and say, this case doesn't have validity. No. My client, Dr. Gracie, came in and said, this is a complaint that doesn't name me as a negligent actor. It never assigns negligent conduct to me. And this court doesn't know, based on this affidavit, whether there is merit to the claims against me. The affidavit is completely offers zero substantive information as to Dr. Bracey, and that affidavit is insufficient. Under the court's ruling, to be sure, in Border, that we file claims based on competent expert opinion, and by doing that, we are avoiding or attempting to avoid the filing of frivolous claims.
So where would you find support in the statute allowing the court to permit amendments, even where the physician's name is misspelled?
I think the statute, in terms of the language of the statute, it says that the allegations in the action must be supported by the affidavit. The affidavit is the expert opinion. The opinion is from the expert. The opinion, just as in Mountain View, the court made it very clear to us in that case, twice the court said the jurat is not part of the affidavit. That was the court being very careful so as not to be indicating that we're not allowing affidavits to be amended. I think that the statute allows us to amend credentials, but I don't think that the statute allows us to amend the guts of the opinion which is coming from the expert affidavit.
If you allow the amendment on 12, where we just put Bracey's name in there, is the affidavit not sufficient that it would say, this is my professional opinion that the medical care delivered by Dr. Bracey was below the standard of care for the following reasons? Is that affidavit sufficient?
I think my position is that if the affidavit identifies the actor, attributes negligent contact to him, and gives sufficient basis to the court to find merit as to the claims, I think the affidavit is sufficient. And that, essentially, that's, interestingly enough, it's the Texas two-part test. I would like, with the court's permission, to read Texas, the two-part test in Texas. And I want to acknowledge to the court that, because it was criticized in my opposition, I acknowledge that Texas has a grace period. Nevada does not have a grace period. But we are not comparing statutory schemes. What we are comparing is the affidavit requirement. When it reaches the end of the grace period in Texas, that expert affidavit requirement looks exactly like the Nevada expert affidavit requirement. They are exactly the same, and the purpose is the same, which is to deter frivolous filings in the district court. So the court in Texas gave this two-part test, which is, first, the report must inform the defendant of the specific conduct the plaintiff has called into question. Second, and equally important, the report must provide a basis for the trial court to conclude that the claims have merit. It's a simple test, and certainly it serves our purposes in this case handily, and it's in line with the purpose of our statute, which is to ensure that claims are based on competent expert opinion.
What is your view of the test offered by Mr. Bryson?
I have to say I had a little trouble tracking it. I think it would have to be repeated to me for me to be able to comment on it adequately. I'm sorry.
Sorry. I just would like to compliment the lawyers from my standpoint. We often ask counsel to give us some guidance on what we should put in opinions, and you've both done that. So it's nice to receive that suggestion.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it is important because even after the court resolves the claim as to Dr. Bracey, your opinion is adding to the body of work that explains these statutory affidavit requirements. And there is so much litigation, there is so much motion practice in the district courts as to how to interpret that statutory requirement. So in closing, I would just like to say that it is our position that no statute can ever list all of the variables. We will never know what those are because they will always come up. But our job here is to interpret the statute. And so it's my position that a reasonable interpretation of the statute is this. The statute or the affidavit must identify the defendant and the negligent conduct that belongs to him. It must give the court a basis to conclude that there is merit as to the allegations against that individual defendant. If either of those things are missing, I contend that the affidavit is defective. It does not support the allegations in the action, and especially in this case, it does not support the allegations as to Dr. Bracey. The court must dismiss that action because there is not enough substance for the court to determine merit. The language of the statute is exact. It is demanding. And as this court, which is actually the same makeup as it was in the Fieri case, when this court published that opinion, the court was very careful to say that those were protective provisions to prevent, the affidavit requirement is a protective provision to prevent the filing of frivolous claims. The 2002 affidavit requirement, the 2004 enhancements to that affidavit requirement, and the medical malpractice statute are protective provisions. It is not an accident that we see in the statute, but the statute says you shall dismiss if the affidavit is not sufficient. We do not allow amendments because the filing of the complaint is void at that point. You have nothing to amend. We ask the court to affirm the dismissal as to Dr. Bracey. There was no naming of him as a negligent actor, no assignment of conduct to him, and the court does not have sufficient information so as to determine whether there's merit to the claims as against Dr. Bracey, and we cannot look to the complaint to do that for us. Thank you.
Mr. Bryson, a minute.
Thank you, very briefly, first and foremost, I want to make sure, Justice Paragraph would ask a question. I thought I said that it wasn't deficient. my learned counsel said that I may have said, I want to make sure, we don't believe it was deficient, we believe it was sufficient. Second, as to Fiore, don't forget, that case, again, there was no affidavit that was originally attached. That's why they said you can't amend that, because it doesn't exist. So we have to find a way to make it exist. The clear language of NRS 41A.071, which Justice Seata agreed with, you've got to look to it. It doesn't state in there what must be included in a supporting affidavit. And certainly if the legislature had intended to make all these specific requirements, if they wanted to make it a bullseye, they could have drafted the law to make it a bullseye. They understood that it had to be, I submit, to in a certain manner so they could fit all cases, because it would be impossible. We say that a legitimate dispute arises when the facts presented in the affidavit in support of the malpractice complaint can lead to more than one reasonable interpretation. And the legislative history on July 30th of 2002 on page 23 states the requirement that an expert in the same or similar circumstances review the records would ensure that records would continue to be reviewed by an expert before they were filed. That's what the history says. Dr. Goldsmith reviewed the records. Did we completely fail under Borger? No. Should we be allowed to mend? Yes, it was attached. We unlocked the key. We took the key. We unlocked the lock. Now we should be afforded all the protections as every other litigant in a civil action, because the rules of civil procedure, they pertain to everyone, all civil actions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This case will stand submitted and will be at ease getting to the next group of litigants.